Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Newism podcast. The Newism's ambition is big. We want to create a new, more inclusive economic system fit for the modern world. Some of the world's most innovative and exciting minds are already creating solutions to fix our broken society, but they often have to do it in isolation and in spite of the current system. Each week, we invite social innovators and disruptors onto our podcast to discover how they would shape a new system if they were given a blank sheet of paper. Our only rule is that the conversation is constructive and positive. Our guest for this episode is Dr. Catherine Trebeck, researcher, author and co-founder of the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, which aims to support and convene people driving change for a happier, healthier world and society. Catherine is an expert in positive economies that benefit all people and the planet, so we're excited to hear her point of view.
So here we are, I'm speaking with Catherine Trebeck. Hi. Of the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, which is a very new organisation. But before we go on to talk about that, because I'm really interested to talk about that, tell me a little about yourself. You previously been just until recently working with Oxfam.
Yes, so I've had, over 8 years working with Oxfam in various different roles. Prior to that, I was working mainly at the University of Glasgow, so I've been all up living in Scotland about 12 years now. But with Oxfam, a couple of different roles. My first role with Oxfam was in a Scottish-facing role, doing policy and some research, looking at really what's the nature of the economic model in Scotland, how is it serving people who are experiencing poverty, why is it that in such a rich country like Scotland, like the UK, we've still got huge extremes of inequality, huge amounts of poverty. People's life expectancy in some parts of Scotland is going down. We're putting more than our fair share of pressure on the planet. So really asking those big questions. And then I did a year as kind of a sort of policy manager for the UK, and that was very frustrating. I worked out that I'm not cut out to be an inward-facing manager, and then I moved from there to the research team, which I really loved, and it was taking those same questions about what's going on with the economic model, how's it contributing to social justice and sustainability, taking that to Oxfam's global-facing work, so working with colleagues in South Africa or Brazil or Vietnam and asking those similar questions, and then also thinking about, well, how can what we're seeing around the world also apply to the UK? What is it about the UK's economic model that's putting the brakes on the life chances of the people we work with around the world?
So it sounds really, really interesting and very relevant to what we're trying to do. So what were some of the conclusions you came to, when you were looking at that? So what were the reasons? Because it does appear that the if you just use Scotland as a microcosm, a lot of wealth being created, the rich get richer, and yet you still have this poverty. And even you have government initiatives and government action and public finances into trying to tackle the problem, we still have the problem. I mean, what, did you come up with any kind of insights or conclusions as to a way forward?
Often more questions than I'd say conclusions, but certainly a sense that we've got an economic model that is geared up to create a certain type of wealth and financial wealth, and that's done in a way that not only puts a lot of harm on people and planet, the wealth that's created often is sucked up and by those who already have wealth. And particularly that has to do with how we purpose the economy. We've got an economic system that's geared up to increase more and more GDP, gross domestic product, but also at the sort of firm level, that micro level, we've got so many businesses that are designed in a way to increase returns to shareholders. So if you think about it, shareholders, people who by definition are pretty wealthy already, they're lucky enough to own shares. And even if we say, what about pensioners? I mean, if you take the global perspective, being lucky enough to have a pension already puts you in a pretty privileged position in the global picture. And actually only 3% of the UK stock market is pension funds directly. So we're seeing even those pension funds being crowded out by people really it's their assets or their money that's making more money for them because of the way these businesses are designed. So we've got these business models that are orientated to put down pressure on wages or put down pressure on the prices that suppliers charge and also cut corners around the environment. And we see the dire impact of that almost on our news screens every day. And what happens is that money gets shifted upwards and so that those who are fortunate already to have money get more and more. And the term is that sort of that rentier economy. And we see the, you know, the harm of that, you know, people reacting against that all the time, people's sense of frustration. And so it's just led me to ask more and more questions about the nature of the economic model. And what's, I think, exciting is that more and more people are asking those questions as well and taking a good hard look at why is it that we've got an economic model that's not really serving people or planet. It's only serving the pockets and the profits of a very few.
Yeah, it would certainly appear, economic information indicates that money is going to money, wealth are getting wealthier, the gap is growing, and actually even people in work now, a lot in the Western world, are just kind of surviving, just making ends meet, which means actually they're not able to save anything anyway, so they can't kind of move on to the wealth ladder at all. So you've almost got, it's not a twin economy, but you've kind of got one rarefied rich part of it, and then the rest of us, as it were.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, do you think, how long can this kind of economic model sustain itself, do you think?
Well, I mean, the signs are that it's already chewing itself up, because even if we were to allow that the idea that of, you know, gross domestic product, GDP, being a goal in and of itself, we see it that being harder and harder to generate in the rich advanced countries of the global north, for want of a better term. So we see, even in conventional terms, that story is running out of steam. That objective is just proving, you know, it's harder to get blood from a stone now, it seems. So even if we still acknowledged, you know, and had GDP as a goal, and I think it's very dubious whether that's an appropriate goal, but parking that, it's running out of steam. So I think even from that perspective, we need a new story, need a new goal for the economy. I think also we see that the harm that growth orientated, that profit orientated, that short-term model of doing the economy is putting so much harm on people and planet that it's in a way eating itself up. And whether it's people who have seen their living standards stagnate, recognizing that their kids are not going to have a better life prospects than they did, and that's a huge change. I mean, this is almost first generation in decades to have a sense that their kids will not do better than they will. And whether it's also then the fallout from that and the way people are responding in terms of reaching for what might seem to be solutions at the ballot box, or taking short-term outlets themselves through sort of, you know, their own behaviours that are harming themselves or harming those around them. And then even if you look at the impact on the environment, and it's not just climate change, it's biodiversity loss, it's ocean acidification, I mean, all those different elements of harm on the environment, we're seeing that really starting to hurt people and sort of harm our natural resources so much that there's just, you can see that there's no way business as usual can carry on. And yet the conversation in mainstream media is very much, how do we keep this show on the road? How do we push down on that growth pedal faster and faster?
So I mean, this is really, really interesting, because obviously we talk about the newism, so we talk about that we kind of are in a place where I would agree strongly with you that this current system is not sustainable. Okay, how do we move forward? And that's what we're talking about, the newism, where I'm kind of going, no, we want blank bits of paper, leave all the negativity at the door, please. Mm-hmm. Right, how do we move forward? So, and I know that you think the same way. So a key question to me then is, how do we move forward then with a new economy that isn't about growth? If you're kind of saying, no, growth isn't there, and maybe that's totally right in terms of the finite world we have, how are we creating the basis of economy that is nil growth and that's okay?
So I think, first of all, is sort of to unpack that term growth, because there's loads of things we want more of. And I think what's one of the frustrations I have in a lot of the conversations around, whether it's corridors of power, or I mean, even just hearing the morning, the news, or opening a newspaper, growth, the term, is rattled off as a ubiquitous, unilaterally good thing. And what we need to really do is sort of kick the tires of that concept and say, actually, well, what is it we need more of? And what is it we need less of? And because it's such an abstract term, it's like sort of going to a restaurant and just saying to your waiter, I want more. And I mean, they're going to say, well, what is it? Do you want more wine? Do you want more bread? Or do you need more chopsticks or whatever? You know, we need to ask, you know, given all the challenges of the 21st century, what is it our communities and our planet needs more of? And so I think opening up that conversation making it all right to have those questions, sort of really sort of putting on the table those big, massive questions that somehow seem forbidden, to be able to say, do we really need an economy that's geared up around GDP, or can we have an economic system that is put in its box as in service of people and planet? And I mean, I take your point, we don't want to get stuck on the negatives, but I think it's important to remember just how much people and planet are currently in service to the economy. Mm-hmm. And so if we can flip that on its head and say, okay, what's an economy that's in service of us look like? Then we start to ask a whole lot of different questions. And I think asking those questions is the key first step. While we're doing that, though, what's really exciting and I think gives me cause for hope, despite the enormity of the challenge of changing an economic system that so many of us are working on, what's exciting is that we already know what this looks like, because there's lots of projects and initiatives and businesses and people who are working on this in their different ways. And whether it's academics or amazing progressive businesses who are sort of using that vehicle of business to deliver social and environmental objectives, or it's community projects or people setting up community gardens, or there's such a plethora of activities that show in microcosm what a different sort of economy look like. These are the sort of chinks of light in a way. So it's not really a step into the unknown, because we see it there. The problem is that when we've got this sort of lens of GDP as this is what the economy is purposed to be about, we don't see those things. But if we take off those GDP glasses and we can see this amazing work that's happening that often isn't counted by GDP because of the way GDP is designed, then we can start to see, okay, this new economy, we're calling it a well-being economy, because mm-hmm. it's an economy that's geared up to deliver well-being and the collective social sense. Then we start to see, actually, this isn't scary, because we see it happening. We can see it embodied in all these different, in all their rich diversity. The key challenge is that currently so many of those initiatives are happening despite rather than because of the system. And I almost sort of, I was likening it the other day to a friend, it's almost like a river with some rocks in it. And at the moment, because those rocks are isolated, that water of business as usual just flows on through. And yes, those rocks are there and we can see them and they're beautiful, but they're not significant enough to change that direction of travel of that water. And this is what this new organisation is about, this Wellbeing Economy Alliance, is to try and connect up some of those initiatives. And again, to keep that river metaphor, if you start to pile those rocks onto each other and put them next to each other, then you can change the tide a little bit. And so that's what's really exciting, is that there's just so much happening, but it's in isolation all too often.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting, because it's a very similar place that we're in. I mean, probably approaching from a slightly different angle. But my view would be is, yeah, they are in isolation. And right, how do we connect them up then? And how do you connect them? Not just on the people that are doing the community garden or the people that are doing business that's got a bit of CSR in it, but actually how do you connect up these, the theory behind them, the in some senses the values, why are people doing that then? Because, you know, what's the reason? How do we connect those up into a kind of theory that makes sense, that then governments and big businesses or small businesses or we the people or whatever embrace? Isn't that the challenge?
That's massively, and that's something that we're hoping we can contribute to as well. And it's really brilliant to be able to work together with other organisations like yourselves that are trying to do that too. Because there's lots of thinking out there as well. And I think part of the problem is that in terms of theory, the way the academic system works out, it's this sort of reductionist approach where people are put in their little silos in their sort of academic departments, and they're rewarded by becoming experts on a very specific issue. And so they go deeper and deeper into those, I won't say rabbit warrens, because I think that very detailed expertise is useful. But the challenge is that looking across those different fields of expertise and fields of knowledge is not so much rewarded. And yet that's what we need right now. We need people who have got sort of that solutions and systemic orientated perspective, rather than just folks who know every last letter of some esoteric piece of thinking or literature or history or economics. We need people with that sort of, who can see the whole rather than just a piece of it. And so I'm not sure though that is going to come from our friends in academic corridors, though there are amazing exceptions that do prove that rule. So I think one of the things we're going to try and do at the Wellbeing Economy Alliance is start to try to weave together some of that different thinking, whether it's coming from ecological economics or from heterodox economics or from sociology or from marketing, and try and piece it together and then turn it into not only accessible, because the idea of something being behind a paywall and then written in obtuse academic language is not really how we're going to change the world, is it?
We're in the same place.
Yeah. But then also feed it into policy making, because when we saw the shift from Keynesianism at the end of the 70s and early 80s to what some people would call as neoliberalism, I wouldn't, for various reasons, we can maybe have a chat about that later, but for a shorthand, this sort of financialized, some people would say maybe market fundamentalist economic system, there was a very deliberate project about seeding that, one, shaping that academic agenda and having the particular journals or something that were really rarefying that sort of knowledge, but then getting it into the corridors of power. And I think that's what we've got to do really proactively now. And one example of something that we're trying to work on at the moment at the Wellbeing Economy Alliance is we're supporting an initiative that's trying to bring together a new coalition of governments, of states and regions that are pursuing wellbeing economics. And similarly there, the challenge is that if people are doing that on their own, if policymakers are trying to push forward about this, the risk is that they'll be ridiculed by their mainstream media in their countries, and that on the global stage they'll be mocked. And yet there are these politicians and policymakers who are trying this. And so what we want to do is connect them together and help them not only showcase their work to the rest of the world and say, look, these are the sort of champions of policy making that we need for the 21st century. These are the sort of the role models. This is the sort of development we need to be pursuing, but also recognizing that none of them are perfect yet. So we need them to work together to go on a journey of continuous improvement. And the countries we're working with are places like Scotland, like Slovenia, like Costa Rica. We've just elected an amazing new president who's all over this agenda. So there is exciting work out there.
Yeah, I know there is, but I would agree with you. They're kind of isolated. Yeah. I think probably where we're coming from is we're trying to create, if you like, that newism. So it's first rather than different policies that are happening and supporting them. So that in terms of your Friedmanite or neoliberal liberal economics that came in, well, they came in with a kind of theory. Okay, based on very market-driven concepts, I think we're in a place that we need a completely new ism altogether. One of the challenges I would say that the economists at the moment is they will write books or come up with new ideas, but they're actually based on the current system. My view probably is that the whole system's knackered, so and not put it another way, it's not sustainable. So how do you create sustainable economic system? And you have to start from a position of, okay, what values are we working around? And it seems to me that some of those discussions just aren't being held at all. What values do we want? So we want to live in a fair world. What does that mean? We want to live in a world with no poverty. Well, what are the implications? So what are we? And I'm interested, where are you in the kind of values part of an economic system?
I find those values conversations actually really heartening, because whenever you really sit down and talk to people, and I think this is a key difference that you've already hinted at, that so often those conversations just aren't given the space because people are so busy in their daily lives, or the way politics is working right now, or it's very opinion poll led. I mean, even a friend of mine who does a lot of work around sort of the democratic system once said, well, opinion polls, they ring you up when you're making dinner on one busy evening and you're juggling kids and getting ready for the next day. And he says they ask people what they think when they're not thinking. And so even just getting a sense of public attitude, whether it's through referenda or through opinion poll or through just voting once every 3, 4, 5 years, they're just tiny, they're almost the most superficial of democratic processes. I mean, they're not even taking the pulse. They're just, to stretch that metaphor, sticking a hand on someone's forehead and then making a judgment about how well they are. Mm-hmm. And so I think your point about creating spaces for those conversations is really vital. And I've been lucky enough in some of my different projects in Oxfam to be part of trying to create those spaces. And when we first met Mel many, many years ago, I'd done a project called the Humankind Index in Scotland, and that was...
Which I thought was really interesting, by the way.
Yeah, it was really fun. There's lots I'd do differently. Lots of things. I thought it was a pretty rough-edged project.
But it was an interesting intervention.
Yeah, and it became... that's fine. It was more influential than we could have dared hope in sort of helping open up that conversation. But what was lovely about that is we were asking people what really matters to you and giving them time to sit and debate and reflect with each other. I then did a similar project with my colleagues in Oxfam India, and particularly reaching out, as we did with the Humankind Index project in Scotland, to some of the most marginalised groups. And again, having those conversations, sitting around with women or with Muslim groups or tribal communities, and asking them, you know, what most matters to you. And a good friend of our new project, Wellbeing Economy Alliance, has done a very similar initiative in Namibia. And you look at any of the conversations that are coming out from those sorts of initiatives where people are given space to stop and discuss and listen to each other and maybe argue a bit with each other, but sort of kick things about between them. They come up with such remarkably similar things that matter to them. And it's completely intuitive.
So they would be?
Family, sort of sufficiency of income, having enough money. People don't really want have sky-high salaries, but they want enough. They want that money to be secure so that it's predictable, so that they know it will come in, so they can sort of relax in the security of the regularity of that local environment, knowing that you and those you care about are safe, and then particularly relationships. And you'll see that wherever you are in the world. I mean, that's backed up by neuroscience. It's backed up by massive large-scale surveys, particularly some of those that were done around the Sustainable Development Goals. So from all different quarters, we do have a sense, I think, that there are some, caution, use the term universal, but pretty common values and goals that are held by people wherever they are in the world. And that they're remarkably similar. What's different is how the economic systems in different places, how good they are at helping people meet those goals. And I think, you know, the risk of circling back to the very beginning, I think the real profound worry is the situation we're in now is that actually we've got this economic system that doesn't really give us stuff about those goals. It gives us stuff about so many other important things. So the values conversation, I think, is actually easier than we allow ourselves to think of it. I think we've just got to open up those spaces.
Absolutely. I think the values are there. And people as well, in these similar type of conversations I've talked about, we'll talk about fairness in there as well.
Yeah.
So it's about identifying what a community is and then that community being fair.
Yeah.
So I think people will kind of say, you know, people can get on in life, but actually the current system is just not fair anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's not people just banging the table saying this ain't fair, it's just the system doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'm emphasizing many, many times, I've done a lot of talks around the world and asked hugely different groups from different backgrounds, anybody think homelessness is a good idea? So nobody ever once has said that it's a good idea. So why do we have it then, as I asked the question? But I tell you that kind of anecdote because it's people's values. You see, they don't think, but we have it, and so it's ridiculous that we all don't think we should have something like that, but we have it. So it's the system. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of going, it's the system, everybody. It's the system that's creating that. If we all know that we need to change the system, is that something you kind of?
Oh, absolutely, and I think that the challenge is that there are lots of great initiatives. And I mean, to take the homeless as one example, homelessness issues, that there's a lot of initiatives to support individuals who are experiencing homelessness and maybe find a solution for them as individuals, and they're extraordinarily important. I mean, I've spent 8 years working for an organisation that does a lot of humanitarian intervention, and that's desperately, desperately needed. But why it's important to also have a conversation about the system is that we might eradicate homelessness for one individual and the next individual and the next individual if we get them a house or get them a job. We're not eradicating homelessness. as a huge structural challenge. And so we need to have both conversations at the same time. And that's sometimes it might be a different organisation, and that's fine, because organisations have different areas of emphasis. That's entirely fine. But I think the harder conversation than just talking about solving a situation for an individual or a community is actually solving the driver, and that is a wider spread.
Absolutely, and that to me is key, because obviously I work in the space of homelessness, and you know, I would like to think our initiatives and projects have been very successful, and indeed they have for many individuals. But the problem is, when you sort the problem out for one, somebody else arrives the next day, almost, or more than one. And so it's a system failure. It's a global system failure. And there's only so much you can actually do as individuals to solve this problem, which is actually getting worse. So I think I totally agree with you. And that's where we need to have the discussion. But some people get uptight about this discussion, I find, particularly in the voluntary sector, because you're basically needing to have discussions like, how do we put ourselves out of business? How does the how does Oxfam or Homeless World Cup or whatever, how do we put ourselves out of business? Because really we shouldn't be in business, because these problems shouldn't exist. That's the sort of discussion we should be having.
Yes. And I think often I've had some conversations these last few weeks about the whole notion of philanthropy and charity. I mean, these are 20th century concepts. I mean, wouldn't it be amazing if we could imagine in 50 years' time where people don't have cream off so much money that they then talk about having to give it back, but actually they didn't take so much in the first place. And actually we don't talk about charity where we talk about justice, where we have this economic system that, when I talk about serving people first time around, it's not just running or trundling away, creating all this growth, creating all this profit, and then looking maybe backwards to the state or to charities to clean up some of the mess, quite literally in an environmental sense, but also putting sticking plasters on all the harm that it's created. And I've been working on a book recently that we've just submitted to publishers, and we talk a lot in that about how much of that growth, sort of vehicle of growth, is actually sort of almost being on a hamster wheel, because it's being churned back in to helping people survive. It's that sort of, basically a sticking plaster or a band-aid on steroids, because we've got this economic system that's doing so much harm, then spending so much fixing that harm, and then it has to get bigger to have that money to fix things, and yet it's not even doing that fixing very well. Mm-hmm. So it's an extraordinarily difficult conversation to have, partly because so many people have their livelihoods bound up in it.
And people do it for good, it comes from the heart. It's not a bad motivation.
Yes. Yeah. And it's rewarding too. I mean, to be up front, close, and and helping people, and that's bringing out the very best of human instinct, isn't it, too?
Yeah. So I do agree. It is difficult to have, and people don't like it sometimes when you're kind of going, hey, no, what your organisation should be doing is trying to shut the door, as it were, close down. People don't like it because they think you're kind of not being nasty about it. But actually, that's the discussion we need to have, is what system have we created here?
I mean, at the political level too, I have this dream that one day we'll have political campaigns where we have a policymaker who's trying to get elected in an election campaign, and actually they go out and do speeches saying, vote for me because there'll be 1,000 fewer police and there'll be 1,000 fewer nurses because people are safer and healthier. I mean, we're a long way off there, and no due respect to police and nurses because they're awesome, we'll always need them.
Yeah.
But imagine if we could have that sort of conversation where people just kept healthier. They're not always having to show up at accident and emergency. Where our streets are safe, where people are feeling secure, and they're not having to. I mean, we'll always find other work to do. There's plenty to do. There's plenty of activities. So, I mean, we're a long way off that yet.
Because the systems are all connected, of course. Because if you start talking about a value system, you're talking about an economy system, then the political system will actually follow. And I'm quite interested in that. Take China, for example. So they have three charities, I think, in China, the last count or something. So they have a view which is, charity doesn't work, well, we, the state, will, take care of all of these things and make sure that in our society everything is okay. I mean, that's not working either.
Well, who decides what okay is as well? And I mean, I think when you come back to sort of democratic freedoms, I think there's huge question marks. And I mean, I have to admit, I have questions around this, because to be fair to China, they're doing some good work around climate change and pollution, and that's exactly. And this is where you see the might of a state that's not slowed down by sort of democratic processes that can look long term, throw its weight around a bit, and in this case, for the benefit of the planet. But I'm not one who, you know, I'm a student of democracy. I trust people ultimately, but I think the key thing is that, and this is what we were saying a bit earlier, if you give people the chance to sit and talk. I mean, people, you often, when you talk about having faith in the public, every so often I'd get someone in the audience mocking me, saying, yeah, but then everyone will be voting for capital punishment. Or, of course, they're not going to vote for the environment because that's so long term. And I disagree with that, because I think it all depends on the nature of the conversation. And in my experiences with Humankind Index, with these other projects I've been involved in, just spending loads of time with people, if you do sit down and have a chance to chat with them, you know, this is the whole thing, school of thought around deliberative democracy, people are pretty damn thoughtful. When you do get back to those values, when you root those conversations in those common values, but the problem is we're so far away from those sorts of conversations governing our political process at the moment.
So it's really, really interesting what you're saying, actually. I mean, people have said to me before, we're kind of moved into a post-democratic age. Mm-hmm. So that democracy is no longer fit for the global world. And there's maybe a bit of truth in that, but they're kind of saying as well, you're not necessarily throwing democracy out the window then, but actually democracy really needs to move on a bit.
Yes.
So, you know, you can look at people, older people who, after the Second World War, their big democratic right was to vote. And so they voted, and that was it. Nowadays, people just don't accept at all because we've moved on that the vote is just it. It's got to be a lot more. And so do you think that's right? Are we moving? Do we need to move into another world because we've become so global?
I mean, I think democracy needs a massive reboot. We can't keep using that same sort of operating system that we used in the 20th century, not least because the challenges are so enormous and so complex and so long term as well. I mean, it's not just about, you know, getting the potholes fixed and making sure there's streetlights on. The challenges facing today's generations are much more complex and interlinked, as you said, all those systems interlinked, than they perhaps were in the past. And so we need a different way of doing democracy. And I will carte blanche hold on to that, because where are we if we give up on it? I mean, that's the sort of system we'll... Maybe we deserve all the climate change we get if we're going to give up on democracy. But I think, again, it's the same way I'd take the word growth and unpack it a little bit and look under the bonnet of it. Also with democracy, I think voting every couple of years is a pretty very thin form of democracy. It's the bare minimum. We need much richer processes, no matter how messy and complex they are.
Yeah, it's so interesting, this kind of area that you're getting into. But it's you know, within that, though, it's about how the money circulates. That's where... You know, the original economists and people that invented the stuff, you know, it was about, okay, how does money then or finance wheel, create the oil to wheel your new democracy or whatever. And really what we're talking about is the whole way we had to cut currencies, the whole way we do global financial markets, levels of investments really are no longer fit for purpose.
No, but they could be. I mean, imagine if we take the democratic conversations further. Imagine if all our firms were much more democratically controlled. I mean, and we've got the model there. It predates modern corporations in cooperatives. Now, they're not perfect. They've got their own flaws and you know, subject to sort of human mistakes, as with anything. But I'm still really excited by the idea of economic democracy through cooperatives and other similar business models where you go.
No, I mean, it's just, sorry, I hate interrupting, because the challenge at the, I'm absolutely with you, but the challenge is really kind of this local global to me, when you're talking about a cooperative. So a cooperative in a village or in a city or in a country or in across
wherever
the globe.
It depends. So it depends.
In your economy, where are we coming from? Is it a global, or is it a kind of series of linked?
I'd love to
local?
See it both. I mean, I think loads of local, but I'm a little bit cautious about rarefying the local too much, because I think then you. then you can get there's a risk of sort of parochialism and just inwardness. And I think we'd lose a huge diversity of views and perspectives and experiences if we haven't a model of a global economy that is just a patchwork of millions and millions of tiny local economies. And I don't think is going to be fit for the future either. But what we need to do is sort of appropriate scale, I guess. In the European Union, they have this awful clunky term, subsidiarity, where terms are taken at the most local level that is possible. So if we could decisions are taken at the most local level as possible, if we could apply that to the economy, I think we'd probably see some sort of economic development decisions taken more locally, and sometimes that would be in firms, sometimes that will be collectively through communities, but there'll be others that should be taken at different levels. I think it's sort of yes and will be the answer to that. And I think it also depends on the product too, because if we're coming back to the concern around the nature of the environmental challenge that's facing communities around the world, then we need to get our heads around an economy that's made up of different products and different services, and they're produced in a different way. And so shipping heavy goods and services, or even worse, flying them to different parts of the world, that can't be part of the future. We need to perhaps localize some of the production. But then there are services and ideas and shared experiences and perspectives and conversations that you absolutely want to flow all over the world as much as possible. And so the Michael Bowens from the Peer-to-Peer Foundation, he talks about if it's heavy, do it locally. If it's light, share it globally. And that's sort of having the yes and being thinking about the issue or the product is probably the way to do it, which doesn't lend itself, that makes it complex, because it makes it a bit more of a complicated story than a 10-point plan for changing the economy.
Yeah, it seems to me that, people have said, I'm sure you've heard the expression lots, that we're kind of in the middle of this fourth industrial revolution. Mm-hmm. And I would probably think we are, but we can't see it. Shifting sands, and we can't. And one of the challenges I think that you're kind of articulating there is that we want to be, in some senses, a kind of global part of the global. You can easily, because you can look at the internet and you can get on a plane and you can be anywhere really. But we're also want to protect our. We're very keen on our identity. What's our? Mm-hmm. Where are we from? And so to get that kind of contradiction sorted into some kind of balance is the challenge for all of us, I think, at the moment.
Yes, it might take some time. Our way forward a bit.
I think it probably does, and I think there's probably going to be some difficulties on the way where you've got some countries that will say be very nationalistic in terms of their this is our identity, whilst trying to work out what their role in the world is. Younger people, they'll probably see themselves more as citizens of the world.
Yeah, more cosmopolitan, yes.
What do you think?
Well, if the world deserves them. I mean, I think there's a big question mark over whether people be wanting to feel a citizen of the world at the moment, and they're retreating into those sort of those bunkers or those silos come from place. And I think there's some people very critical of sense of place, feeding someone's identity. I'm less critical, not least because many years ago, I spent a lot of time working with Aboriginal communities and place and land. For Aboriginal communities, I mean, it's a religious connection. It's familiar. It's a relationship. So the sense of place, I think, is part of our part of who we are as human beings. And to decry it as nationalistic or patriotic or with this sort of derogative sense of the term, I think is really, really sad, because it's almost natural human instinct to have a sense of where you are and where you're from. I think the challenge is when it's seen as a barrier and a way to put, compare and shut out others and contrast and see yourself as better than or others as worse than you. That's when it gets really, really toxic. But it doesn't have to go that way. But I also think in terms of how the conversation, it really does come back to these conversations. That's why sort of initiatives like this are really exciting, because you're, again, opening up spaces for discussion and people to think and reflect and compare ideas.
Yeah. I mean, I guess in some ways it's when you kind of look at these communities, you can maybe see, hey, this is kind of the answers. But then, we're all interconnected, so you can't. Even more so, we're interconnected, so you can't kind of put them, in isolation. I always kind of tell a story about, which I maybe mentioned to you before, about one time I was in the mountains of Bolivia and came across this village which, to all intents and purposes, was paradise, you know. Beautiful fruit, I mean, tasted fruit like it, and happiness, people very happy. Children running around, smiling and laughing, and people smiling. And then we had a big, in the middle of this little village, they bought a big, huge, long table. We got this long table, and we all sat at this meal. Children didn't have any shoes. Children didn't go to school. And the average age expectancy was about 50. Mm. And all based on whether the crops were successful or not, kind of how things went. And so I'm there, I'm with some other social entrepreneurs, and we're talking about what interventions we could make here. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, I don't think I'm going to get a right to make any intervention here. But then I'm challenged by, no, but there's real poverty here. Mm-hmm. How do we, as outsiders, move on and connect here? Because actually in isolation, you could actually argue that this is paradise.
Yeah.
Up here. Uh-huh. So I'm always challenged by these type of issues for me, because in some ways their economy was, their little local economy worked absolutely fine.
Yeah. And you often hear that, don't you, that cliche rolled out by folks who visit these sort of beautiful parts of the world is, oh, material poverty but spiritual richness. And probably depending on who's saying it, I often cringe, but I think the key word in your story there is intervention. I know you well enough to know that you wouldn't go into a community and just intervene. You would sit down and talk to people and say, hey, what can we do to help? What would you like? What's useful? There's a wonderful quote from actually an Aboriginal Australian activist called Lila Wilson, and she says, you know, if you've come here to help me, and she basically says, bugger off, you know, go away. But if you've come here because your freedom is bound up with mine, then let us work together. Yeah. And I think it just comes back to, you know, working with folks to identify what matters to them,
yeah,
and how that change might happen. And
yeah, no, absolutely. That was our conclusion, by the way, at the end of this kind of being challenged. We were kind of saying, actually, the intervention, in inverted commas, was partnership.
Yeah.
So actually, and partnership in the real sense of the world. So we could do X for you, but you do Y for us, which was kind of going, yeah, well, we're all kind of where I'm from, we're all unhappy, so how you've got this happiness? You give us some of your, share some of your happiness, and we'll share some of whatever, a school or something. And that was our conclusion. And there was beautiful, because there was a Mexican farmer with us who was horrified that they were burning the crop, they were burning the crops that hadn't grown or whatever. He was horrified about this. And they had this big meeting in the middle of them. This field and talking about burning or not burning, and it was great. And the Bolivians all agreed with the Mexican in the end, so that, you know, it was about sharing and what, it was nice, it was a very nice moment. But I mean, that's about, you know, as you've talked about before, it's about our humanity. That's what makes one optimistic. Mm-hmm. But there's so many of these current economic practices that present a challenge, not least of which is the kind of whole financial system of the world. And it's how do we, you know, create an alternative to that? Or what, no, it's not how do we, it's what is the alternative to that that stops that? I mean, even, you know, we had the introduction or the suggestion of a Tobin tax, mm-hmm, which was a minor, as you know, was a kind of, I forget what it was, 0.01%,
yeah,
it was 0.05, Robin Hood tax,
it, yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Robin Hood tax, absolutely minor, minute,
yeah,
on each, which raised millions, yeah, on an annual basis to tackle poverty, and that was thrown out by everyone as the most disgusting idea on the planet. And
gives you a real sense of power in decision making, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Something that could benefit the huge majority of the population was kicked out because it would put a little scratch in those with the most power.
Even
and
a scratch, I don't think. Yeah. So it's when you're, the point I'm trying to make is when you, that's against you, it's, you kind of really have to say, no, this is the alternative, people, everybody. This is what we're getting into, you know. And that then relates, tax is another issue in this new economic system. Well, where's the tax then? And to me, the issue around tax is, it's about a relationship. So the reason people don't want to pay tax or whatever is because they don't trust the government to deliver whatever the government said it was going to do with your money. In Scandinavian countries, and it's not universal, but in Scandinavian countries, the people there are happier with paying the tax, much higher taxes, because they trust the government to deliver on the public services, and then they do. So that's it's a kind of deal. Yes. It's those sorts of issues, it seems to me, that we really have to get into a new economy. It has to be going, where is tax set? Where does global financial systems work? And those are big challenges for us.
And there's also some chicken and egg about some of those questions too, because are people in Scandinavia prepared to pay more tax because they're more equal? And so they have more of a sense of solidarity with their fellow citizens as well. So the idea of investing in a system that supports other members of their community is more tolerable and more something they're much more happy to contribute to as well. And I think it's a desperately sad situation in the UK and other parts of the world where the narrative around sort of what you and I might think about as just basic solidarity has been split up into strivers and skivers, or in Australia they talk about lifters and leaners, and it's just this really toxic sort of prizing apart any solidarity that and society once had, that you thought, well, my taxes are going to support, if not me, fellow human beings. And of course the reality is we all benefit from tax. I mean, that all the stats would show that most tax isn't about redistribution from richer to poor, it's about across people's lifetime, but that's different conversation. But fixing those financial flows and how, but also I think the design of businesses is really key as well. I mean, so we have businesses designed in a way that they're in service of those basic needs. So, and through that, the financial flows as well. And so if we're designing businesses where profit making or being commercially viable is a vehicle rather than the ends in itself, then we're using all the best bits of businesses. I mean, I have no problem with businesses being competitive and being efficient if it means they're doing their job better, if that job is about making the world a better place. If their job is about extracting money for the very wealthiest, to then for their assets and their rents and their financial piles of money to make more money from them, well, then that's pretty very much a different situation. Some of the conversations we're having with We All, the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, so far, is giving me cause for hope that I think there are a lot of people who are deep within that financial system who are also recognising that business as usual can't carry on. And I suspect you probably have no similar people.
Yes, absolutely. And privately, they'll say, by the way, it's not good. Yeah. We're terrified.
Even on its own terms? Because they care about the future for their kids and their grandkids. And I think the key thing will be, again, making those spaces for those people so they don't need to just utter it to you in private, but we can have that open conversation saying, come on, this system's knackered. Let's think about designing this differently. And there are amazing organisations working on finance, and there's differences of opinion amongst them, which is fine. That's important at this stage. But again, I think the key thing is about who's in service of what. You know, do we have a financial system that's in service of those sort of businesses that are better for people and planet, or the other way around?
Yeah, absolutely. So look, we have to kind of finish now. I could go on speaking to you for another hour or two. But I mean, it's really fabulous talking to you, because you're such an optimist. You can see the future in a bright way. Is that right? Am I right? You're an optimist about the future?
I'm terrified about the future, actually. I'm really terrified. But what gives me cause for hope is, I mean, even just very recently, this idea of setting up this new organisation, the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, to connect together all the amazing work. And the idea is to try to create a global new economy movement so that it's strong enough and vivid enough and vocal enough that it packs a punch in the current system. And half of me thinks that's a stupidly daft, insanely ambitious idea. And then what's been amazing in the sort of last 6 months or so that we've been working on this is how many people are saying, yes, that's what's needed right now, and I'm going to get involved and be part of it and work with you together. And they're putting aside their organisational egos, they're putting aside their personal egos, and they're saying, yeah, let's do this together. And that's what gives me cause for hope.
Yeah, so that is really optimistic. Interestingly, same newism is in the same kind of area, kind of very, very constructive conversation. So maybe the final point then, given your optimism, So the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, next stage, you just nearly at the beginning, starting exciting times. You know, what's the next stage for you?
So we're still in that crazy startup stage. We've got a website, but it's haven't even decided on a logo. So all that sort of basic bread and butter of setting up an entity. We're gearing up towards a bit of a launch in September in New York to mark the 10 years since Lehman Brothers collapsed. But beyond that, we're looking together to sort of launch the global movement in Malaga, where our HQ is, in April next year. And in between times and beyond, we're just wanting to create as many sort of meta movements and networks with all these different operators and actors in the new economy. And we call ourselves, as a little staff team, the amplifiers. And half of it's half time, we joke about that. But actually, there's something, this is the point, because we're not the rock stars. We want to be the ones who are amplifying other people's work. Yeah. And so that's what we're going to be really busy about, is sort of supporting other people's work and making it louder.
Yeah. Okay, that's fabulous. So, Catherine, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. We will certainly, on our website, as soon as you've got your bits and pieces ready and everything ready, we'll make sure that we're kind of amplifying what you're doing, for sure.
And likewise.
And we'll keep in touch, and we might have another chat again or with your colleagues, because it's been really, really great, really constructive. So thanks again for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
We found it so refreshing to hear such constructive input from Catherine, and left our meeting feeling optimistic and hopeful for the future. We'd love to hear if you agree with her point of view, and also your opinion on what we need to do to create a better economic system. Please do get in touch with us via Twitter at newismtalks, or via our website, newismtalks.com. Our next episode is with Michael Sarney, who is revolutionising youth democratic participation with his organisation Bite the Ballot. See you there.